House Judiciary Committee at 1:07. Members present are Porter, Green, James, and Berkowitz. We have two items of business today. HJR 7, which the sponsor is here. It's no taxation without voter approval. And the other is Senate Bill 67, Truth and Sentencing Act. So we'll start off with you, Representative Martin, if you would please indicate your presence by name, rank, and serial number, and lead us through your bill. No, no, that's all right.
I'm trying to think of my serial number, 1375510. It's been a while since I've had that one. My name is Terry Martin. I represent Beach Anchorage. And over the years, the people of Beach Anchorage and all over the state, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, have been concerned about taxation ever since it was repealed. Alaska is one of the states where a simple majority is needed in which to impose a tax, personal tax of one nature or another, on the people. And I felt that this does not give the people any voice at all. There are a number of states that, well, most states have two-thirds majority. One state even has four-fifths of both houses must approve a tax before it goes to the people. And I think it's either 21 or 24 states always have taxes going to the citizens for final approval. And surprisingly, a lot of people think negative that the people turn these taxes down, but they don't. They're very, very considerate of what type of tax that's brought to them, what is it for, and what they will approve or not approve. So it's not a simple issue of saying, well, we're going to stop taxing, and this is the best way to send it to the people. It's just that I believe the voice of the people is the most important thing that helped develop our country. Boston Tea Party, I was thinking of yesterday on TV. Last night, they were dumping the tea over in Boston Harbor. Well, it's the same thing here. A simple majority of the legislature, and in the past, who did not represent the majority of the citizens, could easily impose a tax upon the majority of the citizens they didn't represent. So that's what I'm asking for again. We've had this last session, last legislature, and the three committees involved all passed it to the floor. And we were four short of two-thirds. So maybe we can do it again and try it. But I think as long as we promote this issue and make people realize that the Constitution is supposed to be the voice of the people, and this should be part of that voice.
Does that conclude your statement?
Yes, sir, for now.
Any questions in response?
I do have
a question. Representative James?
Representative Martin, I'm looking at your 1995 state tax revenues, says Source U.S. Bureau of Census and Bureau of Economic Analysis. Do you know how they arrived at these numbers?
Yes, ma'am. They don't use it as the individual. Oh, you mean Alaska being the smallest one?
Well, it's not the smallest. In this particular case, it says that the per capita dollars of state tax revenues is $3,185 in Alaska, which is 13.6% of the personal income. And as percentage of personal income, it ranks one. I'm assuming that they're talking about all taxes, including including severance taxes and probably not royalties, because royalties are not necessarily taxes.
Well,
are they?
Madam Chairman, we've talked to them twice, to Mr. Manley, when we had these national reports come out, and asked them what criteria they were using. And basically, it shows the total amount of revenues that came into a state through taxing. And they don't break it down too much, whether it was personal taxes, corporation tax, sovereign tax, or what. They just know that this state received perhaps $3 billion in taxes, and then per capita it amounted to this.
Well, and on that point, you know, I guess that one of the things that distresses me, I think this is a good place to say it, is because everybody likes to make a little comparison between Alaska and the rest of the world, especially the lower 48, and they usually do it on a per capita basis or maybe per 100,000 people. They compare our highways, how much we spend on highways. And Alaska is unique to other states because because we are such a large state, with much of our state even being unorganized. And so the other thing that's missing in here, if they were going to use oil taxes and severance taxes in here as taxes, then I think they would also have to include, I don't know if they have royalty in there, in the other states, most of those monies goes into private pockets, not into the state's coffer. So that's going to totally change the whole position. So I guess my final conclusion is I don't have much faith in this thing. Okay?
Right. And, Mr. Chairman, yes. we have written to NCSL, and Mr. Manley was one that given them special information how our taxes break down. In the same way, in the education system under the NEA magazine, at the beginning of the year, they broke down what Alaska pays, and they really made us look bad that we don't support education. So Mr. Manley got a lot of information together from the university and from K-12, and we sent them to the University of Illinois, was it?
Right. Yeah.
And they finally sent us some letter back and said, you got good points. No one's expressed this concern before. And mine was is that just don't go under the general revenue portion of the tactics, what they did. And for the university, they said we were one of the cheapest in the nation in supporting our university. Well, by the time we sent them all the information back of the off-category monies, then they changed their mind. It, oh, well, whoops. And perhaps he said they're going to make an honest effort of giving a more realistic in the next annual report.
Well, yeah.
And on that point, I would really like to see a comparison with Alaska, with the rest of the states, and I think we would show that we're paying less than they are if we only counted the taxes that we pay out of our pockets. But I'd also like to have that compared to the amount of federal taxes we pay in other states. Because
yeah, sure.
if we could get the federal government to give us a tax break, we could afford to pay some of our own, but otherwise I think it's going to be pretty hard.
And, Mr. Chairman, I think we really need to work as a team with NCSL, who does those reports.
Representative Martin, if this sort of thing were to pass, because of all the various programs that the state of Alaska has, as compared to many other states, what are there, 18 different programs or 13 or some number in the teens of programs that we have for providing money for our public that other states don't have, is it less likely, in your estimation, then, that a tax, when and if it, I would presume when, because of the projections of the oil revenues, when taxes are needed, there would be less likelihood for the proletariat to vote for it than what you've indicated, simply because there are still sources of revenue coming in, and people are going to say, wait a minute, I don't think I want to. Get
well,
the taxation.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't.
Or would it work the other way?
I wouldn't dare to guess what the people are thinking. I just know from what I've been observing, and even yesterday in Anchorage, when the people voted on the bond, it was very, very favorable. A lot of people were nervous. They're not going to go for the roads. They're not going to go for the schools. Overwhelming support, because now they see the need, and they don't mind the increase in the property tax and the bonding. Other states have had this experience. And, you know, if the legislature or the governing body presents to the people a good picture and the people realize they're in charge of the purse string, yes, they support it. More taxes go up because of voters' approval than down. That has already been shown.
Representative Porter.
Terry, if this bill were law and this people voted positively on a state sales tax, if the legislature wanted to change the rate of that sales tax, would that require a return?
Yes, sir, it would. Right. So if you have an increase in the state sales tax, say from 2% to 4%, yes, it goes before the people.
Well, your wording says, except as provided in this article, a law establishing a sales tax on personal income.
It used to be increasing.
It has to be approved. It doesn't say amending and existing, it just says establishing. So,
I thought it would both ways or increasing a personal income personal attacks of one nature or another. The law establishes this.
I don't see the word increasing in here. It's
or decreasing.
Establishing, ad valorem. It was meant to be increased, but if you want to add that word, that's quite all right.
I'm not going to vote for it anyway, but I just want to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Rochberg. Incidentally, the record should reflect that Representatives Rochberg and Croft have joined us some time back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Martin, notice you have in here the provision for establishment of a state ad valorem tax on real property. I mean, don't we already have a state ad valorem tax on real property?
Right. Taxing, and that's where the increase, maybe they dropped that word, but I thought we had an understanding for any new taxes or increased taxes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm really quite concerned about this as a member of the Oil and Gas Committee. We've had the opportunity to hear reports, particularly from Mr. Van Meers, that has been commissioned by the state of Alaska as to the development of a Trans-Alaska gas pipeline. And part of his consideration was, or recommendations, have been that we need to reform our tax regime in order to create an incentive for investment in the state of Alaska. And among those is ability to lower, particularly the ad valorem taxes on the capital equipment and materials used for the construction of a gas pipeline. And keeping that in mind there, to make that work so eventually the municipalities and the state of Alaska would be kept whole, there would be a lowering of taxes, or actually potentially even an abatement of those taxes for a period of time, and then after the pipeline reached a level of profitability under contractual long-term obligations, then those taxes could be increased. And I take it that the ad valorem taxes would be one of the primary methods of being able to create a sliding scale type of taxation on these types of assets. So this particular amendment would absolutely bar any kind of negotiations like that.
Mr. Chairman, the ad valorem here meant the real property of the individual had not anticipated, and that's never come up before, as far as an ad valorem tax on the property of corporations, unless you want to go by the law that a corporation is a person. But in this case, it is a personal income tax of the individual, or personal income of the individual to be taxed.
I don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
That would have to be an amendment then, because I don't see that.
Make sure personal property in it.
Representative Croft. Well, wait a minute. Did you actually answer the question?
In that case, I know he's worried about corporations and so mm-hmm. on. This is intended for the individual personal income and their taxes.
Well, I agree with the chairman. I don't see it drafted that way.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Martin, so it was your intent that it be increasing or establishing, not decreasing? Would we have to get voter approval if we were going to knock it down from six?
Basically, it was the imposition of a new tax or increase of taxes, personal taxes. Let the individual speak about their own pocketbook, their own income, and it will be used.
In answer to Representative Porter's question, though, it was the imposition of the tax, and then an increase of that would require it, but I think did we get the response then that if it were to go the other way, though, that also require? I missed that.
Well, for Mr. Norm, personal taxation on personal real property. you want to add that in there?
Well, no, I was thinking about whether, as I understood you to say, unless I missed something, that when Representative Porter asked if it would also apply to the increasing, if you establish a tax and then went to 2 to 4%, and I think what Representative Croft was asking, would you also then need a vote of the people to go back to 2%?
No, not decrease, but only increase. Okay. Mr. Kelly.
Oh, thank you.
Any other questions? We have...
The most important thing here is, should we let the people decide? Mm-hmm. I don't mind the concern brought up, and you want to adjust us so that we're sure that it had to do strictly to the individual. And that's my whole feel. Let the people decide.
If there are no other questions of the sponsor, we have Brad Pierce of OMB who is signed up to testify. Brad, would you identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony?
Sure. My name is Brad Pierce. I'm a policy analyst with OMB. First, let me say we don't have a firm, the administration doesn't have a firm position on this bill. We just haven't had enough internal discussion about it to have formed one, really. I was asked to come and raise some sort of generic concerns about the idea here. First of all, this is a pretty serious business, changing the Constitution to for the legislature to give up one of its fundamental powers, its power to tax and appropriate. You know, it's just the opposite side of the same thing. We see this as a basic difference between the governor's pledge not to use permanent fund earnings without a vote of the people. It was established, the permanent fund was established after statehood by a vote of the people. Clearly, when the framers of our Constitution wrote this provision in here saying that the power of taxation shall never be surrendered, we had taxes then. They felt that the legislature should not give away that power to municipalities or, you know, to others. So I guess those are the fundamental concerns here. We also think that giving up this responsibility will make closing the fiscal gap much harder, because it just forecloses options. It forecloses your options to act quickly. And then also there's sort of the law of unintended consequences here, that we may end up with a very strange tax structure were this to be in place in Washington State, because they've never wanted an income tax. They tax everything that moves. They've ended up with a very regressive tax structure, very high motor vehicle license fees, all that kind of thing. We already have a fairly strange tax structure, getting 80% of our general fund from the oil revenues. So I guess those are the main issues that I was asked to bring to the committee. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Berkowitz.
Thanks. I just want to make sure I understand how problematic it can be if we can't respond quickly to a change in circumstance. Representative Brookberg brought up the instance of changing our tax structure in order to develop the gas pipeline. Are there any other projects that would be affected by our inability to change tax structure quickly?
No, I guess not. The idea, though, is that it sort of limits our options to deal with our fiscal situation. I mean, we're pretty flush right now, and we don't have that kind of problem, but potentially it could, I guess.
Follow up.
And on a lot of other jurisdictions, they've offered tax inducements for corporations to relocate. Would implementation of this provision impede our ability to do that?
You mean to offer credits, or?
Right.
I'm not sure. We have some legal people here. Maybe they can answer that question.
On that point? Because we have James ahead of you.
Oh, yeah, on that point. Matter of fact, the governor has introduced a bill to provide for welfare recipients to have a, the corporation's hiring welfare recipients to have a $1,000 tax credit. And for the chairman's information, I'm also introducing a bill along those same lines about Alaskan residents. So this amendment would tie my hands and the governor's hands and the legislature's hands. And then also on the point of President Berkowitz's, you know, what other things would maybe create this necessity to look at that, I would suggest if the price of oil went to about $8 a barrel, that we'd have to look at this potentially for a protracted period of time.
Those of us with any kind of memory recall when it got down pretty close to that.
That's right.
Representative James.
Yeah, on that point, I guess that I don't see the same fear. And I'm not saying I'm supporting this piece of legislation. I'm just saying that I don't see the same fear of not being able to move quickly. And I don't see that in the future either. All sorts of things could happen, however. But as you stated, we're not poor. And we certainly have, if we had an emergency, we certainly have reserves that we could use. So I don't feel that the timing of getting it out for a vote is a real serious problem. I guess that, and then just to go a little further on that issue, I sit here willing to input taxes on the public when they're willing to do it. And I think most of the other people who say no new taxes are of the same mind. When the public is ready, we will respond to the public, but not before. So it seems to me like that would give substance to Martin's bill, which would then say, well, we want to know for sure that we don't just have a gut feeling, but we really know that the people are in favor of it before we did that. But I guess that, can you think of any specific circumstance other than the price of oil going into the toilet that would cause us to have to do anything faster than we could go after the public? I mean, that's a two-year period is what we've got.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but we're talking about a constitutional amendment here, and to do anything and change to it or a fix to it, you know, we have to wait for another general election.
2 years, yeah.
2 years, yeah.
One more, Mr. Chairman, if I might, and that is the language here that he's got. I have a lot of trouble with is the estate ad valorem tax on real property. I don't even know how you could define that to mean personal property as opposed to other than personal property, because, well, people who have property in corporations, that really it's just a little closed corporations. I think that there's the ownership of property is so varied in so many ways that I don't think there's any way you could pick out personal property and use that. So I guess if we're going to do it at all, I'd like to take that whole part out and just have the state tax on personal income and the state retail sales tax, which are the only two really broad-based taxes that are of great concern.
Representative Roekberg and then Croft.
Mr. Chairman, sir, you mentioned the governor's desire to have some type of a voting mechanism for use appropriation of permanent fund earnings.
Yes.
You know if the governor or the administration has any legislation to this effect or anything?
No, not at this time.
Representative Crowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things. I apologize for being late, but does the retail sales tax that include... Does that have to be across all products, or would a tobacco, an alcohol, a gasoline tax all be within that? Do you?
Or wholesale.
The wholesale taxes?
Well, gasoline isn't.
You may be right. I'm not sure if I could just respond to it, because you, Representative James, told a story about the, when we were discussing the bill allowing alcohol to be taxed at a higher rate. The North Pole did a bed tax, and that allowed them to tax alcohol. I hadn't thought of bed tax as a sales tax before that, but it seems to me then it might be. It was an innovative approach that got me thinking maybe sales tax is a lot broader than I thought it.
It is.
So it might be a bed tax, might be a port fee. I don't know. It's. Do you have any idea whether those sorts of taxes might be included?
I guess you'd have to ask this part.
Representative Martin, could you come back up so that we could make sure we get it on tape? You can bring a chair up if you'd like. So,
in local government, the publics have had the opportunity to vote on the ship tax here or bed taxes, and we have in Anchorage. I have no problem on the state level if the public wants to have that voted on, whether it be alcohol tax, cigarette tax. I have a lot of faith in the people. That's why I want to support this.
Any other questions of either the OMB or the sponsor? Is there, Representative Martin, maybe you could come back up. I support the thought that it should be the will of the people, as Representative James had said that she also supports that. I think probably most of us do. We're in the mode of trying to reduce the cost of government to the point that the people say, that's enough, and now we're going to have to find other sources of revenue. My concern is similar to what has been expressed, and I'm wondering if in order to get what you want, which would be the undeniable will of the people, at least those who vote, of some sort of an advisory vote, some sort of a polling type thing, because if not in other committees, certainly here, that there is a significant concern about how you would manipulate, as would be necessary, constantly going to the people. And if you did that very often, to me, then it is an abrogation of the responsibility of the legislature. We're actually then saying, this is the public's will, and no longer we've in fact violated this constitution unless that portion is taken out. And I don't know that that's necessarily what we want.
Mr. Chairman, major problem with the advisory votes that they have taken place in the past on various issues, and the new legislature said, well, the old legislature put that in. And not many advisory votes have been approved. I think maybe one or two the legislators changed or readjusted on the advice of the people. But basically, it's been a wasted effort. Governor Cooper, when he had the education endowment come up, that was not approved by the people. We see now that the lieutenant governor has just approved an advisory vote on education, but it's almost meaningless. At least in something like this, by giving the people the power, that is final. That is it. No more advisory, no more guessing game, no new legislators saying what the old legislator did that. This is the final. And in most cases, we find out that when the legislatures have done the leading and said that under these conditions, would you support, as Representative James was saying, would you support this? And remember, that's going to take two-thirds of each side of the legislature to approve whatever tax we're recommending. The people do have faith in that way with the legislature. But it hasn't gone the other way through advisory votes.
Representative James?
Yeah. Representative, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Martin, you indicated that other states have a two-thirds vote or sometimes even a three-quarter vote.
Supermajority.
To impose the taxes. We don't have that requirement
here. No, ma'am.
Why wouldn't that be a better way to go?
Well, that'd be half a loaf. I wouldn't mind that. It's just that my personal desire was to have the final vote of the people, the final voice of the people. And in the past history, even our founding fathers wanted to make a supermajority under certain elections. They always said, no, when it comes to the people, we want true democracy, a simple majority. In the legislative halls, because they wanted from the very beginning, this power of taxation is so important for the revolution, for the heart of the people, that they wanted to make sure there was a supermajority in the both houses from the very beginning of our history to protect the people's income.
Mr. Chairman, there's one more thing I wanted to put on the record, because you indicated that earlier on in your testimony that the voters usually will agree and they'll come forward, and you indicated the bonds and the recent Mankiewicz election, but I didn't know if you did know that in Fairbanks they put the sales tax on the ballot seven times, and seven times they said no. And on top of that, when we had the bonding that was available from 1993's legislative position, we put the school bonds out three different times, redoing it and redoing it and redoing it. They finally just said yes this last time when we were about ready to lose the bonding. So I don't know that the public is always that happy.
No, I didn't say yes, always, because you know. Anchorage has turned down some of the bonding packages too in the past. So,
Representative Martin, you may recall in State Affairs last year, there was an issue that brought up that we were going to try and require a varying degree of public percentage. And there was a simple majority, and I believe there was a two-thirds. And there was quite a bit of discussion in that committee that you might not get that. You mentioned, though, other states going as high as 80% or...
In the House...
Did they ever get that?
Mr. Chairman, not of the voters. Once it gets to the voters, it's always a simple majority.
Well, I'm sorry, this is just in the legislature.
But in both houses.
Okay.
I forget which one it is, but NCSL could tell you it's three-fourths of each body. Phew. Yeah, but that's how sketchy they are on making sure that they're representing the will of the people. But most of them are two-thirds.
Representative Croft?
I was interested in the referendum idea. They have the people have the ability to cancel out any law we make by referendum at the next election. That's sort of phrasing yours in the negative, if you will. I mean, we pass a tax, and then they come back the very next election and say no. Why wouldn't that be a better approach? Or maybe a statute that says any tax put on the books shall automatically be placed for a referendum vote. I mean, couldn't they do it through this procedure even constitutionally?
Mr. Chairman, it's a very important question to bring up, because that is what so many other states have as a balancing off from the legislature, the referendum vote. However, as the gentleman said, Fred, in our Constitution, and it's misplaced, it said the power of taxation shall never be surrendered. Well, that's under your Bill of Rights. By golly, we got the power of taxation. We will never surrender it. When you look into the power of taxation under the legislature, we have it. We already took it away from the people. And that's where the irony is. On referendum, the people do not have the rights on any tax provision, either through initiative or through appropriations or through the referendum. In our state, the referendum is almost worthless, because the time restraints for the people to get the necessary 10,000 signatures or whatever, within, we've done that calendar-wise, it's almost impossible in this state to get a referendum through in time to counter what a legislator might have done.
Interesting. I appreciate that, Representative Martin. So is that by judicial decision, attorney general opinion?
No, sir, that's the Constitution made it very clear. When they did that under the taxing powers, it came from the National Municipal League that we use from Chicago as a major guideline on establishing the so-called model constitution. And they were the first one to put in there that the best model was not to let the people have the post strings. And it came directly from them, which is a shame, I think.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I take it the public hearing is closed on the bill, is that correct?
There were no other people signed
okay.
up.
Right. So I'd just like to say that I really agree with Representative Martin's concept in terms of making sure that the public has an opportunity to be known and be heard when it comes to taxing policies and such a major thing. And any change we would do in the future on this issue is, I think, it's a huge state change of public policy. And having voter input and the people having that ability, I think, is very important. I do part company, though, when give credence to the advisory vote concept that we have constitutionally. Now, I appreciate the history of the advisory votes up here, because that's merely what they are. They are advisory, and whether they have to be taken up by the legislature or not is certainly within the realm of the legislative power, and I think that's a very important thing. I mean, there's a tremendous difference between asking the people for their advisory opinion and then following it with the attendant potential political consequences, is something I would strongly agree to and support. But here we're abrogating our entire constitutional responsibility with this amendment. And I'm very, very concerned about that. I just think it's really the wrong approach. On the other hand, I agree with the concept. I mean, I do that. I'm also concerned about testimony we heard about the governor's opinion about the earnings reserve. I mean, that's really extraordinary. I mean, that would be a usurpation of legislative power. Yeah. I mean, not only is it unconstitutional, I mean, it's worse than that. And I'll think of what, I'll describe that sometime.
Not in civil terms.
Not in civil terms, right. But, you know, I'm just quite concerned about this.
President Porter and James.
Well, we've discussed this piece of legislation in previous legislatures, and I certainly respect the sponsor's position and feelings on this particular area of the law. I just have a different foundation of thought on this area and don't think that it's appropriate to, in a state that has, unfortunately, the unusual tax structure that we have, that can be impacted by a single factor. The idea of putting into place an absolute bar that could occur for up to 2 years to be able to respond to that kind of an emergency, to me, is irresponsible, and I just couldn't support it.
Representative James.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a motion for an amendment.
You certainly have that prerogative.
On line 9, page 1, I would like to, after period after income, remove a state ad valorem tax on real property and the comma.
Do you want a period after income or a comma?
I think that it's nothing there, because it's would read a law establishing a personal income or a state service toll tax. So I think we want to be ahead of the comma and after the comma, after property.
Everybody understand that that amendment? We'd strike a state ad valorem tax on real property with both commas. And you have offered that?
I have offered that amendment.
Is there objection? No objection. That amendment passes. And so we have now an amended version. Any other comments or amendments? Yes, Representative Rokeberg.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate what Representative James does, but I still think that the, and I'm very distressed, because I've told the people in my district that I want to make sure that they have the ability to vote on imposition of taxes, but I don't think that's what this does. I mean, this does that, but in such a way that it goes well beyond what I think we should be granting or shifting that power. So I'd just assume the bill sponsor come back. I know he doesn't like the advisory vote thing, but I'm very concerned about that. I think that's a much better way to go. Because that way that, like Representative James earlier mentioned, if we want to make sure we're verifying that that's the will of the people rather than just our intuitive feelings, that I think we'd be well served by doing that. Plus, I would say, too, that, I mean, there is some discussion about whether we should go to a statewide sales tax vis-a-vis an income tax. And I think the only true way to get a gauge on that is to have an advisory vote on that. And if, you know, someday we ever reach that point. Hopefully we won't, because I probably won't vote for it. That's for darn sure. But I just am I'm not sure I'm very troubled by this, because I philosophically agree with it, what the sponsor is trying to do here. It's how he's going about it I've got trouble with.
I think a lot of us do. That's why I suggested maybe an advisory vote. But
well, I agree with the chairman.
Representative Croft, did you have your hand?
No, thank you.
Representative James.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with all the things that Representative Roltberg said. I guess that I'm not afraid to put it on the floor for a vote. And so because of that, I would move it out with individual recommendations and attach this one off.
Is there has been an objection. Is there any discussion? Any further discussion? We have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Bundy? Representative Porter?
No.
Representative Roper?
Pass.
Representative James?
Yes.
Representative Croft?
Pass.
Representative Berkowitz?
No.
Chairman Green?
No.
Representative Roper?
No.
No.
Representative Croft?
No.
The bill stays in committee. Nice try, Terry.
That was quite good. Your mouth.
I had to check the wind here with you guys.
Oh, I can.
You had a caucus going. And watch you guys.
Yeah, we probably should have done that at the caucus before they were coming to Christmas. Now,
well, now you're on the record. Yep.
I know.
And now you're on the record. And so am I.
You didn't have to do that amendment, you know.
The next bill we have before us is Senate Bill 67, Truth in Sentencing. And we have the senator's staffer here. Oh, I'm sorry. Rhett, excuse me. Would you identify yourself and lead us through the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brett Huber. I'm staff to Senator Halford, prime sponsor of Senate Bill 67. Senator Halford introduced this bill to provide victims of crime, their families, and the general public an honest and accurate assessment of the time which must actually be served by a person convicted of a crime. I'd also note that Senate Bill 67 is consistent with the Victims' Right Constitutional Amendment that was passed by the legislature and ratified by popular vote in 1994. Mr. Chairman, you have a sponsor statement, a sectional analysis, various letters of support in your packet. I'd also mention that this bill was heard in the Senate side and the State Affairs, Judiciary, and Finance Committees and passed the other body by a 20-0 vote on the 13th of March. Mr. Chairman, SB 67 is a pretty straightforward bill. I can provide a brief sectional explanation of the bill if you'd like.
Are there questions of the sponsor? Yes, Representative Berkowitz.
The intent, as I gathered reading it from what you just said, is to protect victims, ensure that they know when defendants are going to be released.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, the intent of the bill is to make sure the public has a more accurate assessment of time actually served when a sentence is handed down.
We follow through with this. And one of the components of that would be to know when the defendant is going to be released.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that you can say that with this bill. I think the intent is merely that when the bench passes down a sentence, that the public, the victims, those affected, have an understanding of what the actual minimum time required to serve under that sentence would be.
Representative Berkowitz,
what is your understanding of how sentences are currently rendered?
Mr. Chairman, that's a fairly broad question. Maybe you could narrow that for me, sir.
Representative Berkowitz, we're stumbling here. Could you maybe get to the point you're making?
We've got the whole point of the bill is that judges apparently aren't saying enough in court. And I'm curious to know what the sponsor thinks judges are saying in court that necessitates this bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for clarifying that, Representative Berkowitz. It's our understanding that when a judge imposes sentence, at the time of sentence, makes the imposition, he's talking about and it depends on the crime, it depends on whether there's a mandatory sentence imposed, it depends on other variables, but the judge is basically passing down a sentence of X amount of time. There's, of course, qualifiers, suspending a portion of that sentence, concurrent sentences, et cetera. But what's not being disclosed at that time of sentencing is what the minimum time served would be under conditions such as mandatory parole or discretionary parole. And that's the intent of the legislation, to make sure that those, the minimum actual amount of time that could possibly be served is a part of the information that the folks that are in the courtroom are receiving.
And you also impose here that it can't be less than two-thirds time served or greater than one-third time paroled.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, this bill does nothing to change how current sentences are imposed or mandatory or discretionary parole provisions. It merely brings some sunshine into the process of what those sentences compute into considering those mandatory and discretionary parole provisions.
You're saying those are the terms that are used now? That people convicted now serve at least two-thirds of their term?
No, I don't, Mr. Chairman, I don't think you can say that. I think you can say that people that are convicted now, if eligible for good time, the good time is one-third of the imposed sentence, one day off for 2 days served. But discretionary parole provides an opportunity for criminals to be released before the mandatory parole provision sets in. So it could be substantially less than two-thirds.
Thank you. Representative James.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I don't totally understand mandatory parole and discretionary parole, but I understand where you're trying to get to with this bill because, and I think it would be, probably the judge could do this, but I'm sure what scares me is it would be too little of an amount. For the whole issue, and if it gave them a fairly large sentence, and then you say, well, this is the earliest they could ever get out under this, giving all the consideration of all those things, that you'd have a really small number, which would really distress people a lot. I assume that that's why they don't do that. And so I'd like to have your response to that. Have I read a correct assessment of the situation?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's exactly the situation that the sponsor is trying to get at. He believes that the public ought to know what the sentences that are being passed down translate into under the current parole provision.
One more follow-up, and that is that there has been cases, and not knowing exactly, so I could be off on this, but I believe there are cases when our corrections are full, that one of the things they do is parole people. Now, I don't know if I'm sure they do it all within the framework of what is allowed and what isn't allowed, but sometimes I think probably what happens is a much earlier release than anyone ever anticipated.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct, and I think corrections does what the sentence that's being imposed translates into in minimum time.
Representative Porter?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Berkowitz.
This is mostly for Representative James. Is once the prisoner is sentenced, he belongs to Department of Corrections, and they have control over parole, and the requirement is two-thirds of sentence. You have to serve two-thirds, and then you're eligible for good time. But good time can be taken away. So on a three-year sentence, usually someone will serve 2 years, but if they screw up, they'll do the full three.
But Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that that computation is actually made by Corrections at the time they receive the prisoner after the sentence has been imposed, and good time is basically an automatic credit on account. There is an opportunity to remove the good time if you have some type of behavior while incarcerated. There is also an opportunity for corrections to reinstate that good time after it's been removed.
On that point, Representative Porter?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that you would be able to compute and then advise a victim at the time of sentencing what the earliest time is that could that release could be, but as is stated, it would, and I think that's the information that's desirous to be transferred. That isn't necessarily going to be the time,
mm-hmm.
because of the ability to take back good time because of behavior problems.
Representative Rokeberg, and then Croft.
Well, first, is there anyone else going to be testifying here?
Anybody signed up? We have two people that have indicated they wanted to, but I don't see the sign-up sheet.
Well, I guess first and foremost, I'm looking at the fiscal note. I'd like to know from Brett where the $715,000 is going to go. Is there any idea? Is it an earmarked, or is it because it's federal money, is it earmarked for specific use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rokeberg, it is federal money available through their federal truth in sentencing construction funds for prison facilities.
Okay.
So if you look at the most current fiscal note prepared by the Senate Finance Committee, it shows a $650,000 possible capture of federal funds. Those federal funds would require a 10% match. That's $65,000 of general funds, leaving $715,000 that would be available to the legislature to appropriate for correctional facilities construction if the legislature chose to accept and appropriate those funds.
That's a three-year program.
There's 3 years left in the program. Yes, Mr. Chairman. The estimate of $650,000 is the amount that Alaska would have qualified for had this provision and the language included in this bill in Section 2 been in place. It's possible that that amount will be reduced from the $650,000 over time as other states qualify for these funds.
Senator Rokeberg, did you have something else? I'm sorry.
Yes, it certainly warms the cockles of my heart to see a positive fiscal note, particularly in the Department of Corrections, which I'm very interested in as a member of that subcommittee. One other question. On reading the bill and reviewing the package, it appears that there's no, and maybe in the statute now, it's not my own ignorance, does the court upon sentencing have a duty to inform the victim, or is this looks like it's passive in the sense that it's just added to the sentencing report? Does the court have to proactively go out and identify the victims, and I'm just curious how the process works right now, and then I'll, if you could help me there, and then I have a follow-up to that.
Do any of our legal minds or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rupert, as I understand it, the sentence is imposed both orally and with a sentencing report. That sentencing report is a document of the courts that is available for the victims, but I know of no specific mandate for the courts to provide that information to the victims.
We might address that a little later. Margo Knuth is here.
That's why I asked her, because I'll just express my concern, and maybe we can take it up later if Brent has the knowledge that there's been. I think as we've expanded this area of victim rights, which I'm very supportive of, there's become a problem about identifying who really is the victim.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to speak to that.
Okay.
Or and if this doesn't impose the duty, extra duty, it doesn't appear to, I just want to verify that for the record, that there was no duty additionally imposed on the system to make the report. Thank you.
I see no mention in this bill that would require any specific notifications other than the
whatever
explanation of what the sentence is at the time that it's rendered and the time that it's reported. But if you have a problem identifying a victim, I'll show you the statutory definition of what a victim is.
Okay.
Representative Croft.
Confused about the fiscal note. Maybe could just be my ignorance, but we'll get possibly $650,000 of federal money. That's why it's a positive one. But then we're required to match $65,000 in order to get it. Isn't that outlay? I mean, I understand why the 650 is positive.
Should be at the top as well as the bottom.
Well, but we're not getting that. We're paying that.
I understand. It should have been up under miscellaneous, probably, or change in expenditures or something. It should have been.
So, in effect, it cancels
capital expenditures or somewhere. That 65 should have been also as a spending 65.
So it stays at 650.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I can address that, the fiscal note actually, the Department of Corrections prepared a fiscal note that did show the $65,000 match in expenditures and showed a $715,000 capital expenditure. The problem the Senate Finance Committee had with that is it's not yet determined by the legislature whether they should receive and expend these funds. So they're not going to, the Senate Finance Committee did not feel comfortable with committing to that in a fiscal note, merely reflecting the change in revenue possible, what match it would require, and what the total funding then would be. And the analysis on page 2 of the fiscal note explains that.
Representative Croft, you have...
Well, just a brief follow-up on that. Well, I read the analysis, and so the asterisks up on the Finance Committee mean we could spend that anywhere. We don't know where we're going to spend it. We know we're likely to get it.
But those funds, Mr. Chairman, those funds have guidelines of where they can be spent, and it's for correctional facilities construction.
Or renovation, right? Your note here says construction or renovation of correctional facilities.
And Mr. Chairman, that's what I meant by facilities construction, not necessarily new construction, but construction renovation that's going to provide additional bed.
You said at the very end it's going to provide additional beds. Is it required? Could it be upgrading the lighting fixtures, putting in a new phone system? I mean, what could it be? Any capital expenditure relevant to a prison facility?
Mr. Chairman, and Margaret Knute is here from the Department of Law. She attended the conference in D.C. and I think would better be able to address those specific questions.
Very good. Any other questions of Ms. Huber? Thank you very much. Margo, would you come up and help us out a little? A not uncommon position for you over the years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Margo Knute with the Department of Law, and gosh, I understand there was some little performance last week, legislative skit. I didn't get to see it, but apparently part of it was I come up here and I wave, so I'll do that.
I didn't see it either.
There is a violent offender incarceration and truth in sentencing incentive grant program that the Department of Justice makes available to states, and we have not qualified for the truth in sentencing part of the grant program yet. There was a recent change by the federal department to make it easier for states to qualify, and it used to be that to qualify for truth in sentencing, we would have had to increase the amount of time that our prisoners serve from 2/3 of their sentence to 85%. Truth in sentencing still requires that a prisoner serve 85% of their sentence, but what the Department of Justice has changed is they've said that the 85% of the prison sentence is just the prison sentence of actual incarceration time, and that you don't have to include in that supervised release time, which is what we have with our mandatory parole system for anybody who has a sentence of more than 2 years, and those are the offenders that the federal government looks at, that is our violent offenders, the ones with the longer sentences. So this is called the Minnesota exception, the way of basically bifurcating our sentence on the statute books, but it doesn't change how long our prisoners will actually serve. In terms of what can be done with the funds, they are to be used to reduce overcrowding or to increase bed space, and that can be done in many different ways. And you can renovate existing facilities. There's a provision that allows sharing with municipalities, the theory being that if they will do something with their misdemeanors, that will free up some bed space for the violent felons that the feds are interested in. You can even use it for some planning of expansion. of facilities, but it has to be capital. It cannot be used for operating expenses.
So we couldn't use it to the people that we have sent outside?
Mr. Chairman, actually, there is a provision for using privatized facilities. Again, the theory being that that frees up some more hard beds in Alaska for other offenders. So that.
But isn't that an operating expense rather than a capital expense?
Yes, it is, and that's, Mr. Chairman, why this booklet is as thick as it is.
I see. We've got that covered someplace, isn't
there? That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
And as I understand the situation, then, that the Fed has agreed to that, as you say, that through this is not a new system, but we just don't have the written agreement to that yet. We
That's
are
correct.
Planning. Okay.
We will apply. As a matter of fact, based on the status of this legislation now, we can apply. There's an upcoming deadline, and they will look and see whether the legislation actually passes, and so we should be considered. And the question is, how many more states are figuring this out simultaneously? I think there were only 17 states that qualified last year, so as the number of states increase, the pot of money that's getting distributed is going to dissipate a little bit. But we've just been approached by one of the small states in the East, and they would like to work on creating a floor or minimum amount that each state could get, which would be of tremendous assistance to us and New Hampshire, as a matter of fact. And it wouldn't cost the states like California and Florida that much because they're getting so much money. But to us, it could bring us into the $1 to $2 million range. And so we're going to...
We like it.
Yeah, sounds good.
No objection.
Another
resolution coming.
Yeah. forgot what I was going to ask. Representative Porter.
No.
I'll jump into the breach.
Thank you, Representative Berkowitz.
The intent of the federal matching funds, is that to give more rights to victims? Is that part of their concern?
Through the chair, it is to foster protection of the public, and certainly victims are some of the most interested persons in our criminal justice system.
Follow up, Representative.
There's some other legislation elsewhere in the pipeline having to do with the victim notification system, and it seemed to me that that adds some teeth to the intent of this legislation. It actually notifies the victim when defendant's going to be released or when a prisoner's going to be released. Would implementation of the victim notification system qualify as a renovation under the federal scheme?
Through the chair, I do not believe so. If you were asking, could the funds be used to help pay for a victim notification system, I do not believe so, because it's specifically capital expenditures to increase the number of prisoners that we're able to house. So it's a different part of the criminal justice system.
Okay.
Other people got a Clery problem, too. No, I do recall now what it was. It had to do with the fiscal note that you mentioned Minnesota. Do they have the same type of a system that we do, that there is an automatic probation or release period, and that's what we're addressing? So we won't stub our toe down the road because they'll say, hey, we reconsidered. It's already established.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And at this conference, There was a panel of three different ways that states with determinate sentencing could qualify, and sitting right in the middle was Minnesota, deliberately to help states like Alaska realize that there had been this change and that we could qualify now. And frankly, it's a part of the executive branch's decision that on the federal level that they don't have an interest in coercing us to increase the length of time that our prisoners stay incarcerated, because that's terribly expensive. If we actually had to go from 66% to 85% of sentences for our prisoners, the price tag on that, we would never be motivated to try to participate. They couldn't pay us enough money to do that. But truth in sentencing in itself is a good goal, because there are misconceptions about how long a person is going to be in the system. When you hear a 15-year sentence, as a prosecutor, I immediately think, 10. But victims and jurors out there don't.
Representative Berkowitz. Oh, Kropp, sorry. Representative Kropp was ahead of you.
Margo, thank you for the loan of the book, the Violent Offender Incarceration, Truth and Sentencing Incentive Grants Program Guidance and Application Kit.
Yes.
Have you read the whole thing?
I have.
Well, on page 7, they talk about, in order for us to be able to receive a grant, we have to certify by October 26, 1997, that we have adopted policies that provide for the rights and needs of crime victims. Specifically, states are encouraged to provide recognition of the rights and needs in the following areas. Provide notice to victims concerning case and offender status. And so we've got to, by October, certify that we're notifying victims of the status of their offender. I assume the most important notification you could give would be, he's about to be let out.
Through the chair, that is correct. And that is a statutory and a constitutional obligation that the executive now has. And we are fulfilling it through paralegals and district attorney's offices and through Department of Corrections notification systems when a victim provides the information that they want to be notified. Then we go through this. An automated victim notification system would have the advantage that you could plug in the information, and what it does is it calls a phone number repeatedly for a period of several days until the right code is entered into it to provide this information. There are two parts. One is that, and then the other part is it comes with a 900 phone number that costs $1.80 for the first minute, 95 cents a minute after that, that would allow anybody to call this number and find out if a particular person is incarcerated, where, what their release date is, has been calculated at the moment, and so it could relieve the state of the burden of having to provide that type of information. At, I think we are receiving, we know we're receiving over 400 calls every day about for information about who is in custody, where are they, when are they getting out. If we were to receive over 500 calls a day, then those calls, albeit the people are paying, would have to pay who are not paying now, that would be enough to cover the expense of the automated victim notification part of it.
Follow up on that, I'd just like to make the argument that this capital expenditure for equipment to notify victims can in some cases be a way to save bed space. If there's been a lot of talk of us moving certain classes of offenders into halfway houses and saving money through that method, and some controversy about it, particularly because in halfway houses there's more of a potential for them to walk out and do a crime. it doesn't happen tremendously often, but certainly much more in potential than a hard bid. If we had a requirement that before they're released from hard to soft, I know we couldn't hold them past their sentence while we're trying to get a hold of a victim, probably violating their rights. But if we said before we we're going to do a whole new group of people into soft beds, but before that group does, because of some public safety risk, we're going to require that this notification be done, that the victim have noticed that the offender is going into a halfway house before we do that. That would be a method of reducing prison overcrowding, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kropp, I think there's merit to the argument that you're making. I think that the language of the grant, in terms, they specify what one can do with the funds, and I think that it, my recollection is that it specifically says you must use the funds for construction, either remodeling, new construction, but that's my recollection, is that it was bricks and mortar pretty well, or related to bricks and mortar. I'd be glad to look at it, though, and
show you. Any other questions?
I was hoping to get a look at that book.
Makes particularly good reading on long flights.
If there are no other questions, we have no other people to testify. Representative Porter.
Sir, with that in mind, I would move and ask unanimous consent that the CS for SB 67 move from judiciary with individual recommendations and fiscal notes is attached.
Is there, yes?
I object for purposes of discussion here.
All right.
What I'm trying to look at, and it's occurred to me during lunch, and I had a chance to talk with Representative Porter very, very briefly about it, was provide some teeth to this legislation. Right now, it doesn't do much more than already happens in court. And I think that if we're really intent on providing victims with protection, then we've got to give them notification when prisoners are due to be released. And there happened to be a vehicle for that. I just pulled SB 25, which is the victim notification bill. Now, if indeed we are entitled to federal matching funds as a result of implementing, or was it CSSB 67, then that would more than cover the costs, and I don't recall what they are offhand, but I didn't recall it to be a large amount when I read about the victim notification system initially. And there comes a time where if we're going to talk tough, we've got to deliver tough, and this is one of the ways we can deliver tough. And what I was hoping to do was get a chance to perhaps implement or offer an amendment to CSSB 67, shoehorning in SB 25 where appropriate. And I haven't had a chance to make copies of that yet. But it's still, it's on the same topic. It's consistent with the intent, and it would be at zero cost to the state.
And under the
notification. Yeah, it would. My concern is that I don't know how many others besides me have not had a chance to look at this, and it is appears to be substantial. And we have a standing rule about giving notice in time for the people to see what it is we're going to be, unless. We have a motion on the floor. I'm not sure that this fits into that motion, unless you would prefer to withdraw your motion and we can discuss this.
Mr. Chairman, just by way of discussing the objection right now.
Okay. Representative Roper?
Yeah, I'm not totally familiar with this area. Fortunately, we have Representative Porter here, he is, but I thought Ms. Knute just mentioned that we have a legal and constitutional requirement to notify victims already. And this merely automates them? Is that the differential? I thought.
Have you read this?
And as I understand it, part of the problem is the Department of Law has a hard time getting a hold of people. It's very time intensive, and they're also, because they got to call back over to corrections, get the information, then go out and proactively seek out a victim, whereas this system would essentially eliminate all those the wasted labor, which is taken away from ongoing cases.
I'm not sure what Representative Berkowitz then means by teeth, if we already have the teeth in the law. It's just another method, not teeth.
Well,
Representative Berkowitz.
What it does is there's a couple of advantages. Is first of all, it frees up the personnel in Department of Law to go pursue current cases, active cases. There's a greater likelihood of actually contacting victims. Department of Law people don't generally work into the night, whereas this system could be making telephone calls in the night, which seems to me is a more productive.
Mr. Chairman, point of order.
Yeah, right.
We're discussing a bill that's in another committee. If we had an amendment that laid it in now, it would be pulling a bill from committee. I discussed with the maker objection the notion that this might qualify very briefly, but if it is to overcome all of those other problems, I think it would be more appropriately formed into an amendment after researching the book to see if it even qualifies at finance, which is the committee of next referral.
It is a funding tie, so I certainly would agree with that. It's not a matter of law.
I'd ask for the question then.
We have that.
And I'd withdraw my objection.
All right. Is there objection to the motion to move this out? Hearing none, the bill is moved. I think that's a very appropriate place to put it.
Okay, and that's
it.
Two of them.
Anything else? Anybody want to sing or anything like that? Redo the skits that we missed? Or?
I have a number of amendments, Mr. Chairman.
We